What I always think is that not that I've done so much, but how much more I want to do. And I think that's the key to most of artists' lives. You know, you look back, and of course, I started out as a trumpet player, and I loved it, and it was very meaningful to me. And I played in the New York Philharmonic, and in fact, with Bernstein for part of the time. And the whole time was a thrill. Then I became music director of a bunch of places in New York, Los Angeles, and Seattle, and Liverpool. And I especially was involved in Seattle, where I was music director for 26 years and music advisor, principal conductor, a total of 28 years. And I was helped build a great concert hall there and build an orchestra and become an integral part of the community. And that was the big part of my artistic life. I mean, you know, family life is another story. That's the most important thing, with a wonderful wife and four kids. But the cultural life was to really immerse myself as much as I possibly could in Seattle and in its civic life and its cultural life. And then after all those years, I thought it's time for me to leave and to try to do something else, because if I was ever going to try to do anything else, this was the moment, or you just get too old. You know, it's like, oh, God, now I have to retire. So my next mountain to climb was this whole idea I have of trying to grow the audience and educate more people about classical music. It's really what I care about the most now. And so in that regard, I started something called the All-Star Orchestra, which is an orchestra made up of musicians from 30 major orchestras in the country. And they come together and do TV shows. So we've done 19 TV shows and 6 Emmys. And we're now on the Khan Academy, have reached almost 7 million students. It's the next vista for me. And because what I care about in my life, okay, let's not talk about family, because that, as we all know, how important that is. But on an artistic side, I care primarily about the music. I mean, I love whether it's Bernstein or Prokofiev or Schumann or Beethoven or anyone else. After that, I care about the audience. Then I care about the musicians. I guess to even have it done in a hierarchical way doesn't make a lot of sense, because you care about life, you care about everybody. But in reality, I care deeply about the audience. I want the audience to be there. If they weren't there, I couldn't do what I love. I mean, they allow me to do what I love to do, which is to make music. So what we all want as artists is to have a large audience, and if possible, with some education. So that's the focus on what I'm trying to do now, and besides composing and writing and being involved in every possible way I can to hopefully be a little bit of a spokesperson for this great art form of ours.
You just mentioned that you had worked with Bernstein when you were in the New York Phil. So this concert opens with the music of Bernstein. So tell us about the first work on this concert.
It's a piece called Divertimento. And interestingly, it's a piece I never even heard of. I've done the Bernstein symphonies, and I love them. I think they are extraordinary works, and everyone, you know, has done excerpts from West Side Story. I did the first performance of an orchestral version of arias and barcarolle, a wonderful song cycle. I mean, I've done a lot of his music, of course, this great serenade for violin solo and strings percussion. This piece, for some reason, not only did I not know it, I never even heard it before. As most of you know, I'm replacing John Nelson, my old friend from school, who's indisposed this week. He's had a little operation, and he's not ready to conduct again. So I took his program, and this Divertimento is really what it is. It's a light piece. It's 7 movements. Each movement lasts 2 or 3 minutes, and it is what we would call idiosyncratic Bernstein. Not in the Cotter Symphony sense. So his 3rd symphony is full of arguments and anger and narration. I mean, it's a great piece, but it's a very deep, agonizing piece. This piece is just all fun. Every movement is charming, wonderful. There's a jazzy movement. There's a little fugue movement. There's a march. Everything about it is made for a celebration. And what is it a celebration for? It was a celebration for the 100th anniversary of the Boston Symphony. So for those of us that know about his life, he was a Bostonian, actually came outside of Boston. He went to Harvard. He studied at Tanglewood, and his mentor was Serge Koussevitzky, who was the music director of the Boston Symphony. And he was always intimately involved with that orchestra and eventually the New York Philharmonic as well, and then Vienna and the rest of the world. So when Boston was celebrating their 100th anniversary, they asked him to write a piece. And this is the piece that he wrote for their birthday. And it ends with a big march, and the piccolos stand up, and the trombones and trumpets stand up. And it's like the Bernstein version of Stars and Stripes Forever. It's just an absolute delight. And we rehearsed it yesterday, and the orchestra plays it fabulously. And they obviously enjoy playing it, too. It's a piece that I would venture to say not one of them had ever played before. And the whole idea that the music director here, Joe Hadd, who was a fantastic music director, of celebrating Bernstein's, the anniversary of his birth, to do something of his on each program is wonderful. And I was especially enamored of the program that he did earlier in the season when my son Julian played the Don Quixote of Strauss, where he, in 1943, Bruno Walter was ill. Bernstein was the assistant conductor of the New York Philharmonic. He had to jump in and conduct a very difficult program without rehearsal, and it was a huge success. And so Joe replicated that program as part of this Bernstein celebration, which I think was really imaginative. I wish I could have been here to have heard it. I heard it was wonderful.
I know that the Divertimento also, that because Bernstein knew all these players, he did some extra little musical digs and fun things in there just to get the players and see if they were paying attention.
It's true. And there's one spot where a very poignant moment, everything comes to a stop, and the oboe plays the little cadenza from the Beethoven Fifth Symphony. You know, so we were rehearsing it yesterday. At Bernstein said that everyone in the BSO chuckled when they heard that, that little excerpt from the Beethoven Symphony. And sure enough, last night, the orchestra chuckled also because they didn't know what was coming. And there it is. So yes, he did a little bit for all the players that he loved. He was a man who loved people, loved connecting, bigger than life. Whatever anyone's ever said about him in terms of his personality is true. He commanded the stage. In a room, he was the center of attention. I mean, there's so many stories, but there's one that I thought especially interesting. He came to conduct the Philharmonic, and he'd been away for a while, and there was a violinist in the first violin section named Maxie Weiner. Now, Maxie was a terrific fiddle player, and he looked like a prize fighter. He was a big, burly guy and just a remarkable man on many levels, but his looks were like a prize fighter. And he was like a little puppy dog when Lenny was conducting, came back. And I said, Maxie, you seem so happy. Why are you so happy? And he said, when Lenny conducts, I feel like I make a difference. Now, that's a heck of a statement to make. You have 100 musicians playing, and this man in the first violin section, who's been in the orchestra at that time probably 30 years and plays all the time, knows all the repertoire, he gets, you know, almost teary-eyed because Bernstein makes him feel like he matters. And isn't that the truth? He does matter. Every great conductor knows that every player matters deeply. And Lenny, probably more than anyone else, showed that. We have a mutual friend, a woman in New York who's on the board of the New York Philharmonic and Carnegie Hall and Lincoln Center. I mean, she's very involved culturally. And she said, oh, you have to meet this pianist. I'm going to arrange a dinner. So she arranged a dinner that we'll all get together in April. So then he sends me an email last week saying, oh, I'm so happy we're going to meet before April. He's playing the Prokofiev Third Piano Concerto. Prokofiev wrote 5 piano concertos. The second and the third are the popular ones. The third, the most popular. The first is short, 16 minutes. So, you know, soloists don't want to come and play a 16-minute piece. So that's not done much. The second and third are great, very difficult works. The fourth is written for the left hand only. There was a great Austrian pianist who lost his right hand in the First World War. And then he commissioned lots of pieces. Wittgenstein is named lots of pieces just for the left hand. So that's the fourth, and it's rarely played. And then the fifth, which I think is dynamite, but very, very difficult also, and I'm not sure why that's not played much. Anyway, Prokofiev, I think, is the most important in many ways. He was a great pianist. They say hard-edged, and it wasn't one of those luxurious sounds. He wasn't playing Rachmaninoff and Chopin. He was playing, you know, hard-edged music. For those of you that know about the piano, you know, there's a sostenuto pedal that makes everything kind of a little mushy. Not much of that. You don't use that in Prokofiev. You play very dry, basically, and his playing was known for that. He did the premiere of this piece himself. I think it was 1921 in Chicago with Frederick Stock. So he came to the United States after he left Russia after the revolution, so it was about 1918, and he traveled and came to the United States and spent the next years between Paris and the United States. I don't think he liked it here that much, and that piece and his opera, The Love of Three Oranges, had a great success in Chicago, but not elsewhere. When he did his Third Concerto in New York, people thought it was modern music. It was a different environment than it certainly is today. And it is fiendishly difficult and quite wonderful. I mean, it is a sensational piece. And, you know, I think of, when you think of, you know, think of Bernstein, the conductor, he was a co-director of the New York Philharmonic with Dmitri Mitropoulos. So this is probably 1958. And then Mitropoulos, who was a music director from 50, whatever it was, to until 59, left and Bernstein took over. I mention it because Mitropoulos, who was a Greek conductor, was also a great pianist, and he made his great success in the United States when he first came here by touring, playing, and conducting the third Prokofiev concerto. So this concerto has real relevance to Mitropoulos and therefore to Bernstein, and of course to Prokofiev and to us because he premiered it here. I mean, when you start talking about the small world syndrome, there it is, and very interesting to me, and a great work.
And one of his most famous works. I mean, it is very often performed.
Yes. What's interesting about piano repertoire is that these pieces are so difficult. If someone says, what are you doing this? Oh, I'm doing the Tchaikovsky First Concerto. I mean, that is fiendishly difficult. You realize how many hours a pianist has to practice to be able to play that piece. The same thing is true of the second and third Rachmaninoff. The same thing is true of the second and third Prokofiev. These pieces are fiendishly difficult. Nowadays, I mean, it seems like every college student can play these pieces. I remember a very dear friend of mine, a great pianist, Alexo Tarazzi, would often do the Rachmaninoff second with me. He would do this piece too. And I said, Alexo, let's do the Rachmaninoff third next time. He said, no, I can't play that yet. And this was a mature artist who, you know, was one of the winners of the Van Cliburn competition and so forth. But these pieces are really hard. And nowadays, it's shocking to see these young pianists being able to just knock these pieces off. I mean, you know, we can debate whether this pianist or that pianist is making a great impact and is great, a great artist, and so, well, okay, fine. But just to be able to play it is really quite something. You know, it reminds me of a story. Someone said to me, oh, I don't care for this conductor. I said, really? Well, why don't you care for that conductor? Oh, I don't like her or his, whatever it is. You know, I said, well, tell me. Did the concert start? Yes. Did anything fall apart? No. I said, oh, not bad. it's the same thing with being able to play these pieces. If you could just play the notes, it's really quite something. The fiendishly difficult thing now seems to be not insurmountable anymore.
And the second movement has this marvelous theme and five variations in it.
It's a kind of quirky theme. And so when you hear it, it's kind of angular and unusual. And I think what I try to do, and hopefully we'll try to do, is to emphasize the quirkiness. You know, quirky means you can do almost any melody and make it sound very lyrical and beautiful. Or you can put some hard edges to it, little accents, some short notes, a little imagination. So I approach this the latter way. Right or wrong, I enjoy that kind of unusual way of intoning this theme. And then as a result, of course, I think all those variations, which are brilliant. It was a little unusual for a second movement of a piece to have a theme and variations. It's not like the Rachmaninoff Paganini variations where it is a set of variations. But in fact, it's the second movement of a concerto which are a set of variations, and wonderful. And yes, it's, and then he bring at the end, you know, he brings back the theme while everything else is going on and everything's breaking loose, and then all of a sudden this theme comes back. I mean, you know, he's just incredible genius, an incredible composer.
So what should people listen for when they're listening to the Prokofiev?
Wow, that's a tough question. Well, obviously, you listen to see how what a virtuoso the pianist is, of course. You will hear some incredibly, what we think of today as soaring Russian themes, just beautiful melodies that, you know, when it was premiered in the 20s, had a little dissonance, a little unusual nature. Nowadays, it just sounds like the most lyrical and beautiful music. And then there are tremendous fireworks. Also, he has this kind of minimalist ending. For those that know, you know, it's a kind of, let's not call it minimalist, let's call it repetitive, where he repeats the same chord and the same rhythm with kind of intensity, and then he makes a little shift, and all of a sudden, it's a different note, but it's the same kind of intensity, and then, boom, it ends. I mean, it is just, you know, I don't know, it has everything in it. It has the most beautiful melodies, it has the most inventive ideas, like in the variations, as you pointed out, and it has this kind of motoristic element that makes it thrilling. So it's, I mean, I think for those that can come, you know, it'd be fun to go on YouTube and listen to it a couple of times in advance so you know what to expect a little bit. And then, wow, to hear the fireworks of this piece, it's going to be thrilling, I think.
So tell us about this last work, the Schumann Symphony No. 2.
Wow, this is an interesting story. For anyone that wants to, I mean, of course, there are a lot of movies about Clara and Robert Schumann. But if you want to read about a composer who is troubled with great difficulty on many levels and yet incredibly successful and joyous on many others, read about Robert Schumann. Robert Schumann, of course, was a wonderful pianist who studied with Clara's father, Veck. Her maiden name was Veck, Clara Veck. She was a young piano student in her teens, and he was in his 20s. And for different reasons to do with some hand issues, he ultimately couldn't play the piano anymore. But he fell in love with Veck's daughter, Clara, but she was underage. And so they couldn't marry without his permission. And Clara's father did everything he possibly could to stand in the way of this marriage, because Clara was the great pianist, was going to be a great artist, and he wanted her to not be subservient to a composer, older gentleman. And there were actual court battles. And he tried to paint a picture of Schumann in the press that was not true, in a way that you would think was happening nowadays, the way people try to call someone else a scoundrel or whatever else, you know, it's really quite something. Anyway, he eventually married Clara, and she became a great champion of his music and continued to have a hugely successful career as a pianist. Of course, she's also famous because Brahms became very close to the Schumanns and supposedly fell in love with Clara, even though it was never consummated because Clara was so dedicated to Robert. Of course, after Robert died and Clara was now, after the period of mourning, was kind of available, Brahms ran the other way. I'm giving a very superficial version of an incredibly interesting story. But Schumann himself suffered from a mental illness. He tried to commit suicide a few times as early as 1833. He wrote this piece in the 1840s. It was actually the third symphony that he wrote, but the second symphony, which is now the fourth symphony, was revised. So Schumann wrote the first symphony, then he wrote what is now the fourth symphony, then he took it out, wrote now what is the second, then the Rhenish, the third and the fourth. He revised the original second to be the fourth. That's really confusing. I'm sorry about that. Anyway, he ultimately tried to commit suicide a second time after this piece, obviously, and threw himself into the Rhine, a very famous. Then he was put into a mental institution, and Clara was not allowed to visit him. Now, this is a very short version of an incredibly interesting story. And so I think for probably a year or so, she never saw him. And the doctor said that it would be too upsetting if she would go. And she ultimately went anyway and went to visit her husband and saw him in the institution. And I think 2 days later, he died. It's some heart-wrenching story. Anyway, he lived in Dusseldorf. He was a conductor as well as a great composer. He was a writer about music. He was a great champion of Brahms. He wrote, I mean, in some ways, he did Brahms the greatest service by early in Brahms' career said he was the next great Beethoven. So it made Brahms pretty famous right away. But and the disservice part was that he said he was the next great Beethoven. So Brahms was concerned about ever writing a symphony because it was supposed to be the Beethoven 10th, you know, the great symphony. And he just, for many years, never wrote a symphony until later in his life. And so the Schumann Second is his most popular symphony, I think, C major symphony. It is extraordinary. A first movement that has a very solemn fanfare introduction. He, when he was writing this piece, he said he dreamt about this trumpet and horn fanfare. And that fanfare permeates three of the four movements. You hear it coming back. And this beautiful slow introduction leads to an aggressive, beautiful main part of the movement. The second movement is in some ways the most famous because this scherzo has a very difficult violin part. And it's used for auditions. So what does that mean? That means every violinist, whoever plays in an orchestra, has to audition for the orchestra. You have to, through a committee, and this movement you play at every audition. So even though it's really hard, they all know it. And so when I did it here with the orchestra a couple of days ago for the first time, boy, they just knocked it off. There are many issues in it, but it's a very exciting scherzo, and then has a couple of beautiful trios. Then next, one of the most beautiful, heart-wrenching, slow movements in music. You can hear the influence of Beethoven. You can hear the influence of his colleagues, Mendelssohn and so forth. It has a great, famous oboe solo, so beautifully played here. And then an exuberant last movement. So it was very successful from the beginning when it was premiered. Now, let's see if I can remember. I think the first performance, in fact, was conducted by Mendelssohn, if I'm not mistaken. You know, what's interesting about all these composers, you know, whether it's Berlioz or Mendelssohn or Schumann or Chopin, they're all born within a year or two of each other. And Mendelssohn was a great champion of many of the contemporary composers of the time. And, of course, we all know he was one of the great champions of Bach, and he brought Bach into for everyone to be aware of. Because remember, in those days, people did not play earlier music. They played new music. Mozart, you know, when he played his piano concerto, how come he wrote so many piano concertos? Because nobody wanted the old one. They wanted the new one. In 1 year in Vienna, he did 6 piano concertos the same year because everybody wanted one of their own. Oh, I don't want, you gave that one to Joe. I want the one here for Jill. Give me one for, you know, it was that kind of thing. So to do old music was something that was not often done. Mendelssohn was among the first and was a champion of Bach and brought Bach into the world of mid-19th century German music. Anyway, Mendelssohn was a great champion of Schumann. So, you know, it's all interesting to think that all these people knew each other and they would travel to their concerts. This is before recording. So if you wanted to hear a piece, you had to go to where it was being done. You couldn't just turn on the radio or listen to your CD or go on, you know, Spotify or YouTube and listen to it. It was a different time. I mean, I'm just reading the Harvey Sachs very long biography of Toscanini. And what's so interesting about it, there's so many things interesting, but among them was the fact that Toscanini went to so many concerts. He went to concerts all the time. He wanted to hear the artist. He wanted to hear the music. He wanted to hear the performers. It's really interesting because there's so many musicians, just conductors, but they just don't go to concerts much. I do. I'd love to go to concerts. But anyway, it's interesting. Anyway, this symphony is one of the great symphonies of the 19th century, one of the most difficult. Lots of issues to be dealt with interpretively, and really fun for me as a conductor.
Well, and he uses kind of a thematic transformation in it as well. I mean, he was really doing some amazing things. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this concert and being back in Iowa?
Well, there's so many things. First of all, I love being here. What a great place! What a great state! You go outside and you breathe the air. It's just extraordinary. And here to be in Des Moines, first class concert hall, first class orchestra, and every orchestra has a personality. Some are enthusiastic. Some are a little hard-edged. Some are a little negative. Some are political. There are all kinds of. And it's so wonderful to be with an orchestra, and most are, which has enthusiasm and excitement about doing what they do. You would think all of us musicians should feel that way, but we are no different than any other part of society. We all have our friends who are negative and some friends who are positive. And of course, I only want to be around the positive ones, I'm sure. Jacqueline, you're the same. And orchestras are the same. And here, the environment is so lovely. What Joe's created here is extraordinary, and educationally as well. So for me, coming back, and it's only, if the Des Moines Symphony has one guest conductor here, you don't expect to come back very often because, everybody wants exposure to different people. And unfortunately, my friend John Nelson became indisposed, but I was so thrilled that I was asked to step in.
So just a couple of years ago, you published your memoir, and then you also wrote a new version last year to this Rudolph and Jeanette. So just briefly tell us about those two recent projects.
Sure. I wrote this memoir a couple of years ago. It started out actually with a radio station in Seattle where I was being interviewed on King FM. And the woman doing the interviewing said, "Hey, why don't we do a book of all these stories of yours?" Because she just wanted the stories. And I said, "Sure." And I said, "Transcribe the stories," and a lot of stories to tell at my age, as you can imagine. And then we can edit it and we'll put it out. We'll call it, Conversations with George or something like that. So lo and behold, she contacts me a month later and says, "Hey, we have a publisher." I said, "Oh, great." She said, "Okay, I'll submit some material." And she did, and a publisher called me and said, "I don't like this. I want to do a book with you, but I don't want to do this. I want you to write a memoir." And by then, I was in it. I mean, I had never thought I would do something like that. When you're writing a personal story, hopefully we all think that we're going to live a lot longer, and whatever you write is going to be, it's not going to have the final chapters, and so it's too soon. But in this case, since the publisher was there, he was ready to go, I said, okay. And I loved it. I loved writing it, even though I think of myself as being a forward-thinking person, always wanting to, as I mentioned earlier, looking for the next mountain to climb. On the other hand, looking back was really fun. So I was able to write a whole section about my upbringing with my Austrian parents. And then what I did is I took each institution that I was a part of and wrote a chapter about it. So it was the American Brass Quintet first, then it was the New York Philharmonic, then it was the New York Chamber Symphony, it was called the White Chamber Symphony at first, and then it was the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, and then it was the Seattle Symphony, and then it was mostly Mozart, and then it was Liverpool. So each institution has a chapter, and of course the biggest chapter, or the section of more than one, was Seattle, because we built a hall, and that's a big deal. And so the whole history of building a concert hall downtown is a large part of the book. And it was fun for me to, look back. Nowadays, it's so easy. I probably have, 100 reviews or more in the New York Times. So I could go back and say, okay, 1984, I did what program at Carnegie Hall and what did they say about it? And you read all this stuff. It's very interesting. So I really had a good time writing it. Then I did a little discography in the back and a section about the instruments and what we as conductors should think about with each of the instruments, called Behind the Baton. And I really enjoyed writing it. And now I do a Facebook section called Behind the Baton, where I talk about conducting, and I talk to conductors and composers and instrumentalists. Very short, it's about 20 minutes, and and then we post them on my website. And so that's an outgrowth of that book, and it's going to lead to the next book, which is going to be Conversations. And I'm excited about that. Rudolph and Jeanette, they were my grandparents on my mother's side. So my middle name is Ralph. My mother wanted to name me Rudolph. But when I was born in a Catholic hospital in Hoboken, New Jersey, the nuns told my mother that she couldn't name me Rudolph because all the kids would make fun of me because of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. So she named me Gerard. How'd you get that, Mom? Well, there was this wunderkind on TV, and he was answering all these questions, and he was really brilliant. So I decided to name you after him, whoever he was. And then instead of Rudolph, she named me Ralph. And Jeanette was my mother's mother, and my sister has that name. My grandparents on my mother's side were both murdered by the Germans in 1943 in Latvia and shot into an open grave. And of course, obviously, I never met them. And it was something that affected my mother, as you can imagine, all of her life. She would never talk about it. I mean, I had two older sisters. We didn't prod her much because if we ever brought it up, It was a very unpleasant experience because of the horrors of the reality. I mean, we talk about 6 million Jews being killed and all of that, but when they're your grandparents, it's a little different. And I knew what they looked like, and I know what their names are, and I know the date they were shot, and I know the train they were transported on out of Vienna to Latvia. It's really quite something. And so I wrote this piece called Rudolph and Jeanette about that, about their life, about their imagination, about their time in Vienna, about, you know, and then about their death. And of course, I ended with a funeral dirge, but they had no funeral and they had no real grave. And then I did a version. So this is it was a chamber piece, and then I made it into an orchestra piece. I premiered in Zagreb. And then I did the one you're talking about now is I did a version for the Marine Band, which was it was conducted by Colonel Fedek with the Marine Band, premiered by them. And for me, being in the audience, you know, not conducting it myself, it was, regardless of whether it's a great piece or not, that's not for me to say, but it was very moving for me. And this piece is. And as you can tell, I'm doing a lot of composition now, and that's part of what I, you know, when I was younger, I studied with all these great composers, but it was hard for me to isolate myself for hours writing music, and now I'm much more patient, as you it tends to happen as you get a little older, and so now I'm able to spend time writing and enjoying it a lot, and. And that piece was a very moving piece for me.
Well, thank you for talking about it and sharing that story as well. And thank you for your time today and going over this concert and coming back to Iowa. Everyone's going to be in for a treat to hear your performance this weekend.
It's great to talk to you again. It's so nice to be with you and with people here in Iowa that care deeply about culture and orchestras and high art and things that are so important. You know, one can say more now than ever, but the reality is it's always important. And it takes us to another plane. It takes us away from some of the horrors that exist in the world, all over the world, regardless of where you are. And so we're so lucky to be part of this great world of classical music.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks to John. Thanks to Chris. And have fun this weekend with the Des Moines Symphony.
Thank you so much. I will.